Hey, let's start the show.
It's April 18th, 2013. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Smith, joining me today, always Norman Chan. How you doing, Norm?
Hello. You said you miss Rock Band.
I do miss Rock Band.
Like, when was the last time you played Rock Band?
2012, maybe. It's no fun without people around, and now that we have the kid, there's never people around. We do have people around, then it's,
you can teach
it's quiet
the kid
time.
To play Rock Band.
I think the kid. I hope the kid is going to be very excited about Rock Band. But you know, the last Rock Band DLC came out about 2 weeks ago now, a week and a half ago.
Is that what you're sad about?
I'm kind of bummed, yeah. Like, they had a pretty good run there. They did, like, 4 years. It's 5,000 tracks or something insane out for that now.
I don't think we can be sad about Rock Band if we never bought... I don't think... the last time I bought DLC for Rock Band was maybe 2 years ago.
Well, once we left Future and I stopped having the Rock Band parties every week, then or every other week, then, like, my Rock Band DLC purchases decreased dramatically.
It was such a big thing.
Yeah, we did it every day for every other Friday for, like, 2 years.
It was supposed to be the new Tupperware party.
Well, except for I wasn't trying. Man, I could have sold stuff there.
You could have sold stuff there.
If anybody wonders why we sound a little higher pitched than normal, I apologize. There's construction work outside. So we're just taking out. We took out all the lows. There's no lows here. You can turn your woofer off.
You took out all the lows.
There's no lows. All
so
the lows
in the
are
mixer,
gone.
You...
I turn. Look, I'm going to turn your lows all the way down. Your lows are gone right
so
now.
So what is it? I don't know what that sounds like because it might...
Well, now the lows are back. Say something.
Check one. Oh, that's deep.
Yeah.
I like the lows.
Yeah. Can't we just all be all lows for this podcast?
We could do nothing but lows.
I would like nothing but lows.
Rocking the... Hey, coming in hot from the Cupski to... I don't listen to the radio anymore, guys, so I don't know what it's supposed to sound
Minnesota
like.
Just mention Minnesota or something.
The DJ guy from... Well, don't say Minnesota, because then Will's going to get...
Fuck Garrison Keillor, man.
Prairie Home
Fuck
Companion on your ass. It's like the DJ from Vanishing Point. He had a
the movie, nice the TV,
deep radio voice.
The movie that inspired Death Proof. Vanishing Point.
Did it inspire Death Proof? Maybe it did.
It's the same car. It's not inspired. I mean, it's not inspired, but it's the same car. I'm turning the bass way back down now.
So
down or up?
Down.
Did you know that the Prairie Home Companion is not an NPR show?
No, it's a Minnesota Public Radio or something like that, right?
And NPR chose not to pick up a Prairie Home Companion and produce it.
Originally?
They had one chance to make a decision, and they turned it down because they thought that the listeners of NPR and also the critics of NPR, would see it more as a parody than a loving tribute, which it actually is, and it would fuel the anti-NPR sentiment and the notion that NPR is an elitist organization.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely correct.
Well, because of your sentiments,
yeah,
NPR did not pick up.
Good for NPR.
But it doesn't matter because most public radio stations syndicate it anyway, and so they just assume it is an NPR show.
There was actually a time period, I want to say it was like 80, 81 or 81, 82 or something like that, where the show had been around for a couple years, mm-hmm. and then they went off the air for some reason. I don't know what happened. Like they lost the money or the support or something, and they were able to come back from that. But
one of the best scenes
dark
in
times for them.
The Wire, the TV show, is when one of my favorite characters, Bodhi, is traveling between Baltimore and DC on a run, and he's never really left the city, and he doesn't realize that when you travel outside of the city, the radio stations change.
Wow.
And he doesn't know what's going on, and so there's a whole sequence where he's listening to a Prairie Home Companion, this guy who sells drugs and has never left Baltimore and lives in...
That must be like science fiction.
He was just fascinated by a Prairie Home Companion. So,
and it made his life better, and he lived happily ever after, right?
That's exactly what happened. That is exactly what happened.
I've seen The Wire.
Yeah.
So, Wes, you grew up in a small town.
I did.
How do you feel about Prairie Home Companion?
I fucking love Prairie Home Companion.
Really?
Will. I think it's brilliant.
What the fuck is wrong with you, man?
I'm a normal person who likes good things. That's what's wrong with me.
It's
I've seen Prairie Home Companion live, and it is delightful.
I'm
jealous.
Schmaltz created to appeal to urbanites who don't know better.
It is so not at all.
Oh, God damn it. I'm going to have to listen to this again. Maybe, you know,
Altman's last movie.
It is totally in the tradition of folklore storytelling and delivered extremely well, written extremely well. And even the things outside of the Lake Wobegon segments have their own charm. Like they have the guys who do radio sound effects, and they'll do like the whole bits where they just tell a story through, you know, crazy noises.
So here's the thing. I'm glad you mentioned that, because the thing I don't like is the Lake Wobegon stuff.
That's the best part. The monologue is the best part.
You're incorrect.
What about Guy Noir Private Eye?
That's also the best part. It's all the best parts.
I like Guy Noir Private Eye because I think that it inspired the Patrick Stewart detective holodeck stuff.
I could see that possibly.
Like it's the same. It's the same.
It is
thing.
Kind of the same. Like yeah. intentionally cheesy mm-hmm. Take on. On yeah, noir tropes. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Okay, so it is possible. My opinions on Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion were formed probably long enough ago now that I should revisit and see if I
no,
have
you
changed
should hold to
in
them.
The time period.
Hold to those. You're pot committed.
It's important that we as human beings are willing to look at, self-evaluate and admit that we were incorrect about things. Should we have been incorrect about things?
I think
things?
You should put an egg on it.
I like hard-boiled
Speaking
eggs.
Speaking of eggs and hard-boiled eggs, did you guys see the Tom Cruise, Jimmy Fallon
yes.
appearance? That is a good bit.
So he does that a lot. Like Fallon, this is why I like Fallon. They play a lot of stupid games.
I don't watch
games.
A lot of Fallon.
My wife likes Fallon, so I watch a lot of Fallon.
Has he gotten funny yet?
Yeah, he's been... So
He's more endearing than funny. Like, he laughs. It's just like him on when he did the...
The Weekend Update.
Weekend Update, yes. Where he would break all the time. He would just start giggling. That is his show. Where he cracks up. Like
it's but like the thing that happened is once he stopped getting nervous about doing interviews and stuff, he got quite good. Like he's where Kimmel is kind of where for example, where Jennifer Hudson was on Kimmel the other night. I was watching Kimmel. It turns out when you have a baby, you watch a lot of late night TV because you're up feeding and stuff. That's what's on. Kimmel was like actively a dick to the guest, right? Like he was working her over, making fun of her. Like she had no idea what was going on, it seemed like, and was actively confused. When Jimmy Fallon has a guest on that's maybe not the brightest celebrity or a reality star or something like that, he actually is nice to them and engages. So where Kimmel is a dick, Fallon is a nice guy, but not in the kind of Jay Leno sneering at you through the side of your mouth way that he does his thing. It's like he treats him like a normal human being. He's excited to see, like when Tom Cruise came on, he was excited that Tom Cruise was there because it's fucking Tom Cruise.
Well, there was Tom Cruise promoting his movie Oblivion out April 19th, Earth Day. He went on both Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah,
and they
of course.
Both did very different bits. So on the Kimmel bit for Tom Cruise, he did I thought it was really, really good also. He did a dramatic reading, a Tom Cruise serious reading of silly lines as if he was an action star.
That's great.
And Tom Cruise is very self-conscious. He couldn't do it. He needed the line repeated to him, and you should watch the clip on YouTube. But it was really funny to see him in that like very vulnerable state. On Fallon, he did an equally funny bit, and that was the egg bit. I think, and while regardless of whether you like Kimmel or Fallon or Tom Cruise, the egg bit itself is a great bit.
Well, so the thing that Fallon does with the format for the main guest on Fallon most of the time is couch segment where you talk, and then they go play a game. And sometimes the game is like bowling. They'll set up a bowling alley off on the side stage by the roots. Sometimes
is it humiliating bowling?
It depends on the guest. Like some people are into it. Sometimes I think he played cornhole with Kristen Bell.
Great.
You know, the Midwest throw the sack at the you know the ramp with holes in it. Not anything nefarious. They do things like he did a thing with Kutcher one time, Ashton Kutcher, that was shockingly funny. Where they played war, and when you lost, the other person could throw a glass of water at your
face.
They
did that with Tom Cruise as well.
Yeah, that was the first time. That was the first one he did with Tom Cruise, I think. So, like, I love that segment because it puts people in a different kind of state. And usually, the games are rigged so that Jimmy wins. I think
you think they're rigged
almost always. I don't think he would rig it against Tom Cruise, because, I mean, you don't want Tom Cruise to go fucking crazy on you.
When you say it's rigged, do you think it's rigged in, like, such a knowing wink to the audience way that it's not deceptive?
Well, the water one...
I think
one,
he just practices.
The war one, that's because it was two decks of cards. You can rig.
Yeah.
They didn't show the shuffling of the cards on video.
Right. That you can rig.
And that you can rig in a way... And it definitely seemed rigged, because it was very dramatic, where Fallon was ahead and Cruz was ahead and switched back, and
yeah,
there was a tie with a big, so they up the ante, and at the end, Tom Cruise got to win.
Tom Cruise always wins, Norm.
Well,
it's in his contract.
Except for the egg, in which he slammed two eggs in his face. In a row,
uh-huh,
and Fallon got no raw eggs.
So when you have the eggs, the raw egg is the bad egg, right?
So okay, the way the egg challenge works, I'm gonna stop playing with this pen now. Is
probably
that there's a carton of a dozen eggs,
mm-hmm,
12 eggs, and I believe 4 of them are raw and 8 are hard boiled. So you have a 33% chance of picking at random, theoretically, raw egg.
I assume you can't spin.
You can. The weight doesn't matter. They're all the same temperature and everything.
Right, but you can usually tell there's a momentum shift.
Yes, I don't think
you can
spin it. But the idea is that you pick an egg, you can weigh it in your hand, and you have to slam it against your head.
I see. Now, I think I'm going to go ahead and say, I think this game would be better is if you picked up the egg, and then you decided at that point, are you going to slam it in your head, or are you going to slam it in your opponent's head? And then it becomes a kind of prisoner's dilemma thing.
Before you pick up the egg.
Yeah, I think you have to say... No, I think you have to pick up the egg and evaluate it without spinning and say, okay, I think that this is a raw egg. I'm going to slam it in Jimmy's
I don't
head.
Know if that works.
I don't know either.
I think there's information
it's
gained
absolutely
by the moment
not a
you pick up the egg. I think
dilemma.
The moment you pick up the egg, you've chosen,
mm-hmm,
and that's it. And you have to slam in your head. And I don't know what slamming a hard-boiled egg against your forehead on top of your head feels like, but I'm sure it does not suck as much as slamming a raw egg
yeah.
in your face.
You
know this game.
You've had a
this,
raw
this
egg
game?
Thrown at you before, haven't you?
No, of course not.
Oh, really? Oh, you never did like an egg toss or anything in school?
Can't be worse than the water balloons, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
We don't know. I think a raw egg challenge is best done with a high-speed camera.
Absolutely.
I'm going to pocket this.
Yeah, put that in your pocket. I think the idea of the prisoner's dilemma game is entertaining. It's like the fountain we saw at the Exploratorium last week, which unfortunately wasn't working, but it's two water fountains facing each other, and it is the water fountain equivalent of the prisoner's dilemma. On each side there's a button that says squirt or drink, and if both people press drink, you get a drink of water. If one person presses squirt, you both get squirted.
But if both press squirt,
I don't remember what happens if both press squirt.
I think neither of you get
nothing
squirted.
Happens.
Yeah, cancels out.
Yeah. So, but if only if one person gets squirted. If one person presses squirt, the other person gets squirted in the face. Maybe if you both press squirt, everybody gets squirted.
I think it's neither.
Everyone loses.
I think it's neither, but it could be.
Yeah. Anyway.
My takeaway from this discussion is
yeah.
you should still watch Craig Ferguson over Jimmy Fallon any day.
So I've just started recording all three. Or I record, you know, Fallon and Ferguson because they're both good. And I'll switch when I get up to. So the reason I watch late night talk shows now, and I never really have before, aside from some college years with Letterman, is that when you get up at 11:30 or midnight to feed the baby, kind of you don't want to think like the act of going down the now playing list on the TiVo is so grueling and figuring out what you want to watch. By the time you figure out what you want to watch, you're done with the feed and you can just go back to bed.
The thing I love about Craig Ferguson is, in addition to him just being really, really good off the cuff as a comedian and like doing funny bits, is when he's interviewing people, he does it like he is not on TV or like no one like gives half a shit what he does. So he just goofs off pretty much the entire time.
Well, but he's a dude who knows this person and is talking to them in a casual.
And it's like 40% like sexual jokes and like inappropriate.
He's
stuff.
Late night.
Yeah. late night.
Which I think he has said like he doesn't really have any interest in taking over for Letterman, and like maybe that would change if you know they actually offered it to him.
When there's
but,
a check.
Sure, but he seems pretty content like with his as much as he makes fun of like oh CBS doesn't give us any money and stuff. Like he seems very content in his time slot to have Jeffrey Peterson, the stupid robot, talking to him and yet
no one mentions
off.
Conan.
Yeah.
Poor Conan.
Yeah.
That Tomb Raider thing he did.
Conan
was really
just
funny.
Turned 50 today, I think.
Conan's 50 years old?
50.
Oh.
I read that he had a, there's some, I don't know if it's a text feature or a video feature that he did a sit down with other former Simpsons writers.
Oh yeah. I saw that.
I haven't read it or watched
it. It's a video.
It's a video. Yeah. But that sounds amazing.
I'm going to go find that as soon as we're
Simpsons
done with this.
Writer's room.
Should we talk about tech news a little bit?
Yeah.
Some other people have done emails first this week. We could do emails first. Just get that out of the way, over and done with.
Emails?
Emails.
Emails?
Emails. Let's do tech news. Twitter launched their music app today, or last night late, I guess. It's kind of interesting. I don't know that I need more music discovery services in my life. Like, I think I'm pretty well covered on music discovery services between Pandora and Spotify and RDO and Amazon and iTunes and all the different ways that you can find music today.
I haven't used this. How does it work?
What it does is it tracks, obviously, hashtags. I'm going to open it up right now and kind of step you through it. So when you open it, what it does is it plays music. So it is a music player that uses Twitter as a recommendation engine and discovery. And I assume that they're doing interesting things, parsing what people you follow and what people who you follow and things like that are talking about on Twitter, with the assumption that the people I follow on Twitter are my friends, therefore I'm into the same things that they are. And
this
the
music totally falls into your belief of using Twitter as a way to curate the
noise. It's a way to filter noise, exactly. There's also, if you're into pop music, then you could, the default screen when you open it is popular music, and that is essentially the trending hashtag list for music, right? So right now it is Psy's new song, a Pink song, a Demi Lovato song, a Robin Thicke song, Paramore, Azalea Banks, I don't even know who she is, Pitbull, Linkin Park, I don't know what that dude is, Maroon 5, The Heist, it's just a list of popular music. Same thing. It's essentially the same. I didn't compare, but it seems like it's the same stuff that pops up on like the top 10 on iTunes or Amazon MP3 downloads or whatever.
That does not sound very interesting.
When this first popped up, I was going to say something snooty about Lady Gaga, and then I realized that my popular music knowledge is probably so bad that Lady Gaga is completely irrelevant right now.
She's having hip surgery or something now. She's that old. So she's expired.
Too much gyrating.
So the next tab is about emerging stuff. And this is, I think this is an idea that it's like, it's trending up. It's on the upswing. So it's another, it seems like this is all stuff that is evolving from the algorithms that are behind the trending hashtag stuff that pops up on the main Twitter screen. So this is stuff, these are bands I haven't heard of before, which is probably a good thing. I haven't listened to this channel at all. But basically, on each of these pages at the bottom, there's a thing that I think, especially if you hook it up to your RDO or Spotify account.
So this is a separate app that hooks up to both Twitter and RDO/Spotify?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think you can play, I don't know exactly what the rules are if you didn't hook it up to RDO. I probably should have done that before I did this. But so you can hit play and it'll just play this station. So essentially, you can generate like a top 40 style station or a college radio style station if you assume emerging is that kind of thing. Suggested is stuff that it thinks you might like based on your tweets. And then there's also now playing, which is songs that have been tweeted by people you follow. So it's the equivalent of my Flipboard list that parses out all the links for articles that people that I like have
and
posted.
And somehow Twitter will know that when someone tweets the name of a song or an artist, like those are actual song names. It has some intelligence in its parsing.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, there's a limited number of albums released each year, limited number of artists, and they just put those. And since most artists are actually on Twitter, people say, when you tweet something from RDO, when you say, hey, share this song or love this song, it goes out and tweets it and says, I really love On the Road Again by Nelson.
Yes, because that has, there's code in there.
Yeah.
But if it's just someone just says, oh, I'm listening, you know, if Adam says, oh, I love Dear Avery.
Yeah.
And it maybe capitalizes DNA, like, does Twitter then know, oh, that is a song?
I don't know exactly how granular that gets, but it seems like if you say, like, if you look at the things that people post about music on Twitter, like, just parsing out that this is my jam is probably a pretty good source of information.
I was going to say, that's the only thing I think anybody I follow tweets about. When they tweet a song specifically, yeah, it's this is my jam. Like, that's the only thing people use.
But yeah, so it also looks at the artists you follow. So, if you follow The Decemberists and Willie Nelson and Demi Lovato, then you're probably going to have a real weird mix of songs in there, I would say.
Eclectic.
It's interesting. I like that it integrates with RDO because that adds more value to my RDO. But I really don't feel like I need another music discovery service. I'm going to try it out for a few days, though, and see how it goes.
Why is it not just built into Twitter?
I think, you know, it seems like this is the new thing, right? I was going to talk about this later, but we can talk about it now. Facebook's doing a lot of the same stuff. So they started by rolling out individual apps on iOS and Android for Messenger, the main Facebook app, and then also if you have a third-party page, like our testing page. Like,
for example, the message functionality is in the main Facebook app.
It is kind of. It's not as good, though, I think, right? Isn't that the idea?
Not, I guess, if you just want to use it for that specific purpose.
Yeah.
But I don't think people just want to use, like, they're not going to use music discovery in itself more than they would use Twitter.
Well, but I think this is the idea here is that this is separate. This is a music player that is just based on Twitter information.
So it actually plays the music inside.
Yeah, if I hit play at the bottom of the thing, this will play the list of all the songs that people have tweeted.
All right. So it's a music player and it just taps into your Spotify.
Just happens to use
audio accounts.
Yeah, it uses Twitter for the playback, for the recommendation engine, and RDO or Spotify to play the actual music.
Which is great for both RDO and Spotify.
Yeah, it's good for everyone involved.
Except for Pandora.
Poor Pandora. It's interesting. I don't know that, like the magic of Pandora, and when Pandora first came out, the amazing thing was you started the app up, and it just, you told it one song you liked, and then it gave you another 300 songs in a row that were, you know, increasingly same kind of general area, but maybe one axis off in some cases. It was like having a good, mediocre wedding DJ, I guess.
Well, it was the interesting thing about Pandora, at least what I thought, was the algorithm that they use and the idea that they were going to quantify music
taste in music, right?
Yes, data.
Yeah. So anyway, that's out. It's free. If you have RDO or Spotify, then you can play the music in the app. I think probably the music playback is limited to like short snippets or something if you don't have RDO or Spotify. It's kind of neat.
I think I'm going to dump my music library and just start listening to whatever Mott Braga is listening to at all times.
It's a lot of New Alberta Orchestra or.
It'll be an experiment.
New
Canadian experiment.
New Alberta. What is it?
There's Manchester Orchestra.
Yeah.
And there's the...
who are not Canadian.
Not Canadian. And then there's the new something...
There's of Montreal, who are also not Canadian.
They're from Athens, right?
Yeah. And then there's also the band that's like... There's some naval word in there.
Of Montreal...
No, we just said
that.
No, I thought...
There's something...
Who did you just say was from Athens?
Montreal. Yeah. I'm sorry. We had a no sleep last night. The baby always loves to not sleep on podcast night, it seems. So iPhone rumors. Rumored. Hold on. I'm going to reset.
Wait. Take a deep breath. Okay. Now come out
Let's talk about the Facebook stuff for a minute.
There we go.
I somehow deleted it from the list. But basically, Facebook rolled out Home last week. We tested it. You spent some time with it this last weekend using the HTC One X. It's a weird product.
I was going to say it's a bad product.
I mean, it's just, I don't know who should use that. That's why I say it's a weird product. Like, it works. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just, I don't know if it's for people who are really super duper into Facebook but don't use it very much. Or, like, I just don't get it.
So you're saying...
It's for people who use Facebook like Twitter, and that's it. They don't play the games on Facebook. They use Facebook as a way to get a feed of updates, and the updates are more opinions than news.
When you said for people who don't use Facebook that much, did you mean that as in Home would encourage them to use it more, or that using Home, if you use a lot of Facebook, is not a good experience?
Not a good experience.
Yeah. So it's kind of, it's like a casual interface. It's like an interface for casual users, but that who use Facebook as the internet. Like, remember in the old AOL days when people would sign up for AOL and you had that weird window,
you
the
had
client.
AOL.
Yeah. But the browser, like, people thought the internet lived inside AOL.
Well,
it's
for
the
them,
same
it
thing.
Did.
Well, it did. Yeah. But I think this is for the same thing. Those people, but who treat Facebook, because a lot of people treat Facebook as the internet.
Right, but even those people still will click on stories, you know, for Yahoo News or videos and stuff. And what you get in Facebook Home is even more limited.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about this, though, is along with that, they released a new version of the client for iOS a couple days later. They released I deleted my notes, so I don't know what else they released. The chat heads are in the new version of Facebook for iOS, the thing from the home / Messenger updates. They released Messenger, which apparently was their fastest growing app of all time. Huge growth in that on mobile. And the thing that I've seen reported in a couple places, I think the main one was on The Verge, was that this is a result of Facebook as mobile first. So last year, Zuckerberg said, hey, Facebook is a mobile first platform. That's where people use Facebook. We need to make sure that we provide experiences that are compelling on mobile above all else.
How do they do ads in home? Are there any ads?
No.
No, it doesn't seem like it.
But it will launch the Facebook app if you want to go in deeper.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if they are increasingly mobile focused, where's the money in?
I don't think people have figured out mobile ads yet.
I think the situation is that they want to make sure that they own that market, they'll continue making money on desktop.
They're mobile first in that whenever someone at Facebook pitches a feature, Zuckerberg wants to see how it looks on mobile and how it will integrate into their mobile ecosystem.
Which is really weird because a lot of the stuff that you need to do to have a good Facebook experience, you actually can't do from any of the mobile apps that I've seen. You can't switch between newsfeed and top comments and stuff like that and you can't hide people's posts from your newsfeed in any of the mobile apps. Because the only place I ever use Facebook is on mobile. And it's really weird to me that stuff is all for a company that is theoretically mobile first, that stuff just doesn't work. Anyway, the new Facebook apps are interesting.
You know what I'm seeing increasingly used now when we're talking about separate mobile apps for one company is Vine. Lots of people are using it.
When you say people are using it, are you watching them on Muni and seeing?
Oh, no, he means people he follows on Twitter.
People are retweeting other people's Vines.
I've seen it die out pretty substantially since, obviously everybody's going to try it the first week or two, but it seems kind of sporadic for me.
So I use it to upload dumb pictures of the baby and the dog alternately. That's
Louis C.K. has a bit about that.
I know.
Louis C.K. has a great bit about that.
I know. I'm aware. And the thing it's missing is the ability to upload your own video.
That defeats the point, though.
But you should be able to take it. If you shoot a 30-second video, you should be able to chop it down to the 6 seconds and do it. Because it's really hard to get something that loops right just off the cuff. I understand that's the challenge.
Art.
There's no art in Vine. I'm going to go ahead and be the Roger Ebert of Vine here and say there's no art in Vine. It's just video clips.
Have you seen the guy from Mad TV who fits whole lemons in his mouth?
You mean Will Sasso?
Yeah.
Really?
Spits them out? Yeah.
I have not seen that.
He's the best.
It's just like, open his mouth and there's a lemon in there.
He barfs lemons.
And then there's a really gross half second of him just vomiting it out into
projectile.
A wall or something. Yeah, yeah, just
wow.
Or straight and usually
at the reaction.
I wish it was just like he opened his mouth and the lemon opened and then he closed his mouth and then he opened his mouth and a lemon came out and then he opens his mouth.
It's
just
art.
Just infinite. Okay, so that's art. What I'm making is an art. It's just a way to share pictures.
The thing that kind of kills it for me is just how slow the load times can be and it's not, you don't get any visual indication that it's loading. It's just black box.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there when is this going to load? And it's a 6 second video. If you're waiting longer than 2 or 3 seconds, you're already not interested in that. At least for me, I don't know.
I'd say that's
6 seconds is too long.
Well, yeah, but he's saying if you're waiting 33% of the time to open the 6 second video, then who fucking cares? Move on, and do something else with your life.
Yeah,
what are you doing with your life, Wes?
Designed to be instant. I'm not watching Vines.
God. There's been a rumor about cheap iPhones. Pretty much since the launch of the iPhone, Wall Street Journal's reported on it a couple of times. It seems to be a thing that is going to happen as Apple's way to reach into the third world to address the Android market share in everywhere but the United States and Western Europe problem. Boy Genius posted pictures of what is supposed to be the back shell, which will be, it looks like a polycarb shell.
That's the most interesting part, right? The back of the phone.
Well,
the back of the phone informs the pricing and the positioning of the phone. And if they're releasing a phone that theoretically is for third emerging markets. And it's not something that's going to be for the U.S. market. They're going to have to product differentiate it to justify the relatively still high price of phones in markets where they know people can at least afford to pay, and whether on contract or off contract.
So you're saying it has to be real crappy.
It has to look real crappy, but not perform real crappy. Mm. And the looking real crappy, it looks like from these mock-ups, they got that part right. Because
considering
it looks
how many
real ugly,
like how many Android phones still come with that, like a kind of plastic, sort of cheap feeling shell, like that's
which companies are moving
certainly
away
not
from.
Unusual. Yeah.
So when you talk about HTC or Samsung or LG, and all their high end phones, you know, they're really touting like glass back, uniform, you know, unibody aluminum, aluminum.
Is the Galaxy S4?
It is plastic.
Okay, so I mean, that's weird. And in a good, like in some way, it keeps the phone light and it lets them put more money in, you know, the CPU or whatever, that maybe they're doing a little trade off there. But
or in the past, you know, having a battery you can swap out.
Yeah, but it's kind of weird that like those phones are so cutting edge and top of the line, but they still feel kind of cheap.
I find it really interesting that HTC, on the ads that they, I assume, bought before they had component issues and had supplier issues and when they thought the phone was going to be out now. But the ads for the HTC One are literally saying, look, it's made of metal. This is a phone made of metal. They show the speakers, which I always found a little bit weird on phones, but whatever.
Well, and it's just saying, the detail of how, you know, the machining process.
No, but the ads that I've been seeing late at night on shows that primarily are watched by people younger than me are about, hey, look, it's like a trans. I mean, they're not saying this because obviously that would make them sound super old, but by putting the speakers on the front, they're saying it's something you can listen to music and watch videos and share with your friends. And then also they say, look, completely metal. This is an awesome phone.
I'm not really that down on plastic either, because like, yeah, it can feel cheaper or look cheaper, but at the same time, like, I still have to be way more careful with the iPhone 5 when I'm like pulling it out of my pocket than I did when I had the HTC Evo, because that plastic back had more grip to it.
Yeah. And also,
and I was not nearly as worried about dropping it.
Yeah, and if you dropped it, it compresses and bounces rather than shattering.
And companies like Nokia really love the polycarb that they use, and they tout that, you know, if you do drop it, or if you, over time when you scuff it, it won't lose its color because it's the
all
same
the
color
through.
Throughout.
Yeah. I mean, if I were choosing materials for a device based on personal preferences, I would go with like a awesome look. I actually quite like the Nokia polycarb. I think it's really neat looking. I like that it's kind of ensconces all the delicate parts of the phone.
I don't like the new ones are they're shiny, not matte.
I did the matte blue was pretty awesome. I don't think they even glass would be my last choice, just because it's a usability disaster. So it seems like the cheap third world phone. I don't think it looks that bad. I know you reacted poorly to it.
That was a joke, but
okay. I mean, I think it looks bad.
It is kind of. I wouldn't say it looks great, but I mean,
it looks like it looks so described. If you haven't seen the picture, is that it adopts the design language of the iPad Mini, in that the back of it is more it's less of a beveled corner like the iPhone 3G or 3GS, and it's more of a square rounded corner. Mm-hmm. But unlike the iPad Mini, the back is aluminum. If this is plastic, then it looks more like a candy bar than ever before.
Yeah, in terms of the shape, it really does look like the iPad Mini, just smaller.
Well, and square edges, it seems right. Let's talk about Lumia, since we hit on that a minute ago. Their Q1 results are in. They sold 5.6 million Lumia phones worldwide, and they lost $196 million. It's not necessarily terrible news, because that's Q1's usually pretty soft.
It's a pretty decent number of phones sold.
It is not a bad number of phones for a phone that is 1 year in and is the third place.
Yeah. Is it only on, in the U.S., is it only on AT&T?
It is AT&T.
I thought that they were going to do a Verizon one, but I haven't seen anything come out.
I don't think is there any Windows phone on Verizon?
The Droid does.
For a while, it was all on AT&T.
There's
T-Mobile.
It'll launch, Lumia 928 will launch on Verizon later this month.
Yeah, I knew there was one coming. I didn't know if it was out yet.
It's taken them a while.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, it's a little slow. This is probably, well, we've talked about it. Don't buy phones for what they're going to be. Buy them for what they are. Google's terms of service for the Glass Explorer edition leaked or was found by Wired the other day. Basically, it prohibits selling or loaning the glasses to another to other people.
This is relevant now because the bigger story is that Google Glass is now in the hands of people who paid for them last year.
Oh, the ones that people bought at I.O.
Explore editions are in the hands of people now in the Bay Area. And there have been a couple videos of people wearing them, walking around. The big video that came out yesterday was the go-kart video. So someone went to the Burlingame go-kart place, the indoor go-kart facility, did a couple laps wearing his Google Glass, shooting a 720p video. Which means, well, if you thought vines were annoying, then prepare for a barrage of, you know, awesome first person, quote unquote, awesome, air quotes, awesome first person videos of people doing things in their lives.
There are a couple other things about Glass this week. There's no no ads on the developer platform.
Google will not permit ads.
Google is not permitting ads or unpaid or free apps or paid apps. It's all free apps and all ad free unless Google is dumping ads into the developer preview. So it's interesting. I'm really interested to see what kind of apps are in there. I got into the If I Had Glass along with it. Seems like everyone else that tweeted the hashtag.
I don't think so because it's only a few thousand.
Oh, really?
There's got to be more than a few thousand people who tweeted it.
When I looked at the list, it was like 4 days long. Every 5 minutes they were tweeting to people to say, hey, make sure you follow us.
No, someone culled all the tweets
and
did analysis of the people who received the tweets who got into the program.
Yeah.
And it was several thousand, and it was a weird range. So mostly celebrities, people with
a lot of Twitter followers,
and then a couple people with very few
Adam followers. Got in too, so.
Yes. That is a good way to spend $1,200.
Yes, we will happily spend.
And I say that in the sense that it is a interesting way.
Well, for a piece of content, like we can do a lot of weird content with that. It's the idea. So, although no borrowing, Norm. No borrowsies.
I don't know what borrowing means. Yeah.
We'll have to read the terms of service very closely. The threat is that they're going to turn them off for people who, if you try to sell. I think they want to avoid having them on eBay, would be my guess. And it's important to mention that since it is a dev kit, essentially, you know, this isn't an unusual, like if you get a dev kit for an Xbox from Microsoft, it includes language that basically says, hey, you can't sell or loan this to someone else.
When those show up on eBay, they get real pissed.
Yeah, they go away real fast.
Yeah.
Usually. So the specs for the Google Glasses are also out. Not the processor inside, but in terms of the camera sensor, it will take 5 megapixel photos and 720p video. Of course, that just means resolution. Doesn't mean bit rate or color fidelity.
Yeah, or the noise on the sensor and stuff like that. The pictures that are coming off of them look pretty good, though. I mean, it's not as good as, say, it's definitely not as good as a mirrorless camera.
I can feel the contempt coming off Norm.
Yeah, but I mean, for a sensor that fits on a pair of glasses, it's better than I expected.
I can also sell you a pen that has a camera on it. And
really?
That's a pretty good sensor.
Is it pretty good? How much is it?
For a pen with a camera in it,
okay.
$120. It has Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, BG. Interesting that audio is transferred from you using a bone conduction. So
it hits on your temples. Above your temple. Yeah.
So when you talk, I guess that's how it detects.
So that means you should be able to talk very softly.
Theoretically, has 12 gigabytes of usable storage, with out of 16 total, and you get Google, you know, cloud services.
And then, so how does it connect to the? It doesn't use your cellular. It uses the cellular connection in your phone, right?
No, it's Wi-Fi or Bluetooth.
Okay.
So it can connect
Bluetooth to your phone or your Wi-Fi to a hotspot.
Yes. And the most important thing, though, is the battery, they say, is a full day of typical use. But things like Hangouts and video recording are much more battery intensive.
So does it? How does it work over the... completely lost what I was going to say. Oh, is the little screen in the top right always on?
I believe the screen is always on. They haven't said what the specific resolution of the screen is, but here is their...
For display, their description is it's a high-resolution display that is an equivalent to a 25-inch high-definition screen from 8 feet away. So,
but that isn't always on, necessarily.
If you have a 24-inch monitor, stand 8 feet away from it and put it in the corner of your eye, and that is the size of the display on Google Glass.
Okay. I'm into it. Whatever.
Sure.
They haven't talked about the Explorer Edition doesn't really work with prescription lenses, right?
It says there are adjustable nose pads that fits any face, but it doesn't fit over your existing glasses.
Right, so I'll have to bust out the contacts again. I got to go to the ophthalmologist.
Wait a minute. Hold on.
What?
Is the display on the right side or left side?
It's on the right.
It's on the right side. I'm farsighted on the right side.
Oh, that's good.
No. That's bad because... Wait, no, it's focused to infinity.
Yeah, okay, it focuses to infinity. Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Congratulations.
Worried for a second.
Amazon, we've talked about non-traditional TV networks, and on that beat, Amazon released the trailer for their Zombieland TV show. Have either of you guys watched it?
It's terrible.
It is really fucking bad.
It looks like a bad...
It looks like a fan film.
It looks like a really bad fan film.
It looks like an okay fan. It looks like a pretty good, but it looks fan, like a film fan film written by people who aren't funny.
Where they spent all the money on the special makeup and not on the writing or any of the post-production.
Is this from the guys who did the first movie?
It is the same. It infests the same world. So I don't know I don't know anything about who's involved creatively, but the trailer like does the rules thing. Like it pops up a rule one cardio gag. I was watching. I was like, really? This is pretty fucking grim. Amazon, you better do better than this. You know, if Netflix is rolling out Kevin Spacey and House of Cards, and Amazon's first big thing is this, it's not good. That doesn't look good for Amazon. Google Fiber announced that they're their third city. We went from one city to three cities in like 3 weeks.
Wait.
Yeah,
we're not talking about Austin, right?
No, Austin was last week. We got a new fiber city this week.
Third city.
What was the second? Oh, those two cities right close to each other in Kansas don't count. That's okay. One city. This is the third city. Provo, Utah had a municipal fiber network that Google's going to take over, and they will be the third Google Fiber city. My wife follows somebody on Twitter who went to Kansas City this week and to test out the Google Fiber stuff, and he had tweeted a speed test image of the upload. It was, I think, 750 megabits a second for the upload.
What?
For the upload. Gina says to me, hey, what's our upload speed here? And I said, 5 to 7 megabits a second.
Which is pretty good for the U.S.
That's awesome. Yeah, upload? I had to pay extra for
a
that.
A megabyte a second upload? It's not bad.
100 so she says,
a second.
Wait, how fast is... No, 700
he said megabytes.
Oh, yeah, 100 megabytes a second. Yeah.
That's Steam, a lot.
He said you can download a 1 gigabyte file in about 20 seconds.
That was a moment of silence.
Yeah. Think about that.
Wow.
Like you get up to go to the bathroom and you come back and Skyrim is downloaded. I mean, depending on how long you're in the bathroom, I guess.
Apparently people in Japan have been kind of dissing Google for being like, hey, we've had that for years and it costs like nothing over here. It's the land of free internet Japan.
I remember my grandmother told me a story about Japan's high definition TV sets when I was 8 years old in 1983 or 88 or something. Maybe I was 12. This is nothing new. Japan has always had better stuff like that than us.
Yeah.
And it's a much smaller country, so running infrastructure stuff is a lot easier.
That's always been the problem. Like, just like Tokyo, of course you can get whatever you want.
Well, but on broadband, it rolled out faster in rural areas a lot of times, depending on, like, in the intermediate area. If you're in the range of the CO, you could probably get DSL in a suburban area much faster than in a dense urban area, because it's much easier to run new cables there.
My experience with that growing up was not that, but I didn't have a heavy urban area to compare to, so I can't say you're wrong.
CISPA passed the House this morning. CISPA is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. It is engendering a lot of the same controversy as SOPA did last year, although it's a completely different bill. The idea of CISPA is that it facilitates sharing information related to cyber attacks between companies and the government, and provides legal immunity for companies that do that. So that, say, if I'm upset that Comcast shares my information with Amazon or Google, I have no legal recourse to sue them as a result. And it also describes the way that information enters the federal government, which is through the NSA, as the bill is currently. Obama threatened to veto it because there's some privacy concerns. Actually, a shitload of privacy concerns, not to put too fine a point on it. The problems, as listed by most of the opponents, seem to be that there's no... The description of the information that can be shared goes far beyond the information that's relevant to the attack. It can be shared with basically anybody with no recourse or downside. There's legal immunity for the companies that share, and there's nothing says, hey, what can you or can you not do with this information after it's shared. So for example, if Google shares information with Amazon after an attack, Amazon can then do whatever they want with that information. There's no rule that says, hey, we can't use this for marketing or whatever.
But that's only the House, has not gone to the Senate, and
which is where the last one died.
Yeah. Well, it was filibustered to death, basically. So
that's how everything works now, apparently.
Yeah, I mean,
all the way down to city council meetings.
So I was an intern on Capitol Hill in 1993 or 94. I can't remember. It was first year in college. There was one filibuster during the entire summer that I was there, 3 months. And it was super unusual to the point that Robert Byrd, who was a Democrat senator from Kentucky, stood up and talked for 4 hours or 12 hours or something about? Like that. Civil War. He's a historian, so he talked about Civil War history and all sorts of stuff.
No. If you're going to filibuster, and this should be a rule going forward, if you're going to filibuster, you must detail your plot for Star Wars Episode 7.
But that takes 5 minutes.
So
he did this for like 10 hours.
Is this on video?
I'm sure it's on C-SPAN. There's C-SPAN archive someplace. Wow. He went and he did it for multiple days. Like it was a thing that didn't stop. People like came and sat and watched because he was a good lecturer.
He just talked. Did they try to interrupt him?
And he was an old dude at the time. I mean, he died in office 15 years later, probably. You can't. I mean, the thing is, if you have the floor and you have that's the point of the filibuster. Is you can't. I don't remember the specifics, but it all has to do with the rules of the Senate and basically once
they,
you give
they
the floor,
can yell at you, but you just say the floor doesn't. Yeah, does not, I do not. This, I do not recognize.
Right. It's different than the House. The House has a rule, has a committee that says, "Hey, here are the minutes that we're going to allot to these different to each person. So when your time is up, you either cede the remainder of your time or you talk until you're out of time. Basically,
I'm actually interested now because I've been thinking about it since the gun bill failed yesterday, about the specifics of what has happened with the filibuster in the past 3 or 4 years, and I'm sure there are some good pieces out there that I can read, but it, as far as I know, there hasn't been like a real policy shift that has changed the way the filibuster works. It's just basically the Senate is so divided and the Dems have kind of given weight to the filibuster through some action, through folding on something, and now basically every issue is because that the filibuster now kind of carries weight. It's just, okay, if you're potentially going to filibuster this, we're just going to let it fall apart. Like,
So what happened is there's a filibuster-proof majority, and Congress has been split for a fairly long time that below that, at like 50, right at 50-50.
It's ridiculous that, as far as I know, there's really been no point in history before this where a supermajority was required for like
that everything. That is the thing that's changed, yeah.
Yeah, and now it's like 60 votes, and that's never been the case. And like 60 votes is crazy to have to get that for anything.
Typically,
basically,
you need that for confirmations and stuff like that. Really serious stuff, like sending somebody to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's a few votes short of amendment changes.
So if you want to know more about this stuff, Andrea Seabrook, who used to be on NPR, does a great podcast called Decode DC. There's been probably a dozen episodes at this point. It's relatively new. And she talks about budget stuff and does a good job of interviewing people and getting out of the... it's a moderate voice for a political podcast. I highly recommend it.
She did a crossover podcast with 99%
yes.
Invisible, right?
Yes.
That's where I've heard the name.
It was about the setting up of state presidential speeches.
Yeah, that was a good one.
She did there was one recently about the way moderates have been basically shouted down by the people on either edge of both parties. and then another one on the federal budget and wow. like the it's a fascinating podcast. You keep saying wow over there, Norman.
Strom Thurmond has the record for the longest filibuster.
How long? For like 40 hours or something?
24 hours and 18 minutes. Oof. And it was to be a racist.
That
I'm not surprised.
Legacy.
He stood up for that shit.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess it's good that he believed in something.
Know your rights.
But I don't know. Microsoft's enabling two-factor auth for live IDs. It's rolling out slowly. And I got to imagine there's billions of live IDs out there now. So keep an eye on that. If your Microsoft account is important to you, it is important to turn on two-factor auth.
I wonder how that'll tie into the next Xbox.
I got to imagine the next Xbox is no problem because they'll support it natively. But if it's anything like Google's implementation for services that use Google API but don't support two-factor auth yet, it's got to be a real pain in the ass.
I was just thinking more like, what are they going to do to push the Live ID with the next Xbox?
Do they even call it the Live ID?
It's Microsoft ID.
I mean, my gamer tag is linked to your
Microsoft ID.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then that's it. Mission accomplished.
So you have one.
You're already there. Micro batteries. A paper came out this morning describing. So we heard about supercapacitors a while ago. This was an idea that you take basically like two films of carbon, flat carbon nanotubes. I can't remember, graphene sheets, whatever. And you can make tiny capacitors that in aggregate produce a lot of power and can store energy much more densely than, say, a chemical battery like we use in lithium ion or lithium polymer or whatever. These micro batteries are a brand new thing, and I'm trying to find the page with the description so I don't mess this up, and I don't see it. Here we go. Basically, it's applying the same kind of idea, a lot of tiny anodes and cathodes in chemical cells to produce much higher energy density than we've seen before. I think this is really neat.
But it's still just research.
It's still research, but they built prototypes, it seems like. They specifically say that it's a tiny battery that has enough juice to jumpstart a dead car battery and then recharge a phone instantly.
That's like they're very small. A very useful tool.
A few millimeters in size. Instead of being a two-dimensional flat surface with flat anodes, they're stacked and they're three-dimensional with anodes and cathodes in a three-dimensional matrix, which allows apparently more effective transfer of ions or something.
Very high energy. Anytime you have high energy density storage, it's also scary.
Yeah, because I mean
potential for.
We remember the days of exploding laptop batteries. Yeah. If you ever had a Sony laptop a laptop with a Sony battery rather that bulged and pushed the bottom of your laptop out, that was three steps before it exploded and caught on fire. So
I know some Dells had that issue.
Pretty much every manufacturer on the planet had problems because they were all buying batteries from the same place.
It seems like battery tech is still one of the biggest roadblocks to portable tech. I mean, certainly with phones still. And
absolutely.
It's going to be awesome to see something like this actually become a usable product.
Yeah, and hopefully. And as the disclaimer, I mean, we literally hear one of these stories every year pretty much. Yeah. So sometimes more often. So it may or may not work.
This is the benefit of companies having really big R&D budgets.
Yeah.
They can spend/waste a lot of money exploring these options. And whoever's first to market, if you have a phone that does 10 times the battery life, the same size.
They win.
Yeah.
Netflix is ditching Silverlight and moving to HTML5 streaming. I feel like we've talked about this before.
And it's not happening for a while.
It's going to be a gradual transition. How did they solve the DRM problems with HTML5 video?
I think they haven't yet. And that's they've solved parts of it, but not, they don't have the full solution yet. As I recall, I read this story on The Verge like 3 or 4 days ago.
Yep.
They said there were like two of three, I'm blanking on the right word, but basically like code implementations in HTML5 that need to be approved, and only two out of the three have been approved so far.
Right.
So assuming the third one becomes standard, that will give them the tools to secure streaming so that people can't copy it or whatever.
So there's three W3C initiatives, and the W3C is the standards body for the web, basically. And the one that's missing is the one that allows DRM. They have the delivery streams via JavaScript and some other stuff, but they don't have the DRM encryption.
Right. So
standard.
Assuming that that happens in the next year or two or something, then that's probably when they'll go full in on HTML5. Okay.
Yeah, it makes sense, because then all of a sudden stuff just works on everything instead of having to build custom apps and all that. Although I kind of feel like a good app experience for Netflix is not necessarily a bad thing.
And Silverlight hasn't... And Microsoft has kind of said either they're not going to continue Silverlight or they might not. Like, they're kind of like, yeah, this might be kind of at the end of its road. So yeah. They have to change it to something eventually.
The Silverlight crop dusted the internet. It came, left something behind, and then it went away. NASA is doing a Kepler briefing later today. Kepler is the mission to find planets in the sweet spot.
Habitable zone.
Yes, where there can be liquid water and hopefully enough gravity to keep people on the planets and all that stuff.
It's likely they found two.
Yes.
Two planets.
I saw a story the other day that said basically there's hundreds and hundreds of billions of planets in the Milky Way alone.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah. No surprises.
No, but the two that are, you know, similar size to Earth that are in the habitable zone.
Is Kepler looking nearby or is it far away?
It's nearby.
So it's in like the 20 light year region?
Ooh, I don't know exactly about that.
Okay. Windows 8.1 rumors. I haven't watched this.
Windows 8, the next version of Windows 8 will be Windows 8 Blue, and it's something they've been working on since the launch of Windows 8. But the big new thing...
It's essentially like the point release of the Service Pack 1, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And the big rumor, though, and nothing's concrete, and even if it's the rumor's true, it could change the last minute, is that they are going to bring back an option to have a start menu on desktop.
Praise Jeebus.
And also an option so you don't boot into start screen.
Praise Jeebus.
I would welcome both those changes.
So that's pretty much just admitting, okay, start screen is only for tablets and
whoops,
and desktop is only for computers.
Is optimal for people on laptops and computers.
I think that, I think if they actually do that, then that indicates that they are giving up on the, we can force 600 million people into the Metro modern app ecosystem by forcing them to do this.
It doesn't bode well for people developers who've invested really heavily in modern apps.
No, I think it's super bad news for them. I've done a couple of informal Twitter polls, which are completely not scientific. But when I ask people what their favorite modern Metro app is, they all invariably, like one person gives a serious response, and everybody else just says desktop.
Yeah, I saw that.
I also, last night, Gina used my Windows 8, my gaming PC, for some work stuff. And it was really fascinating because I don't think she'd ever experienced modern apps before. My Windows machine is always on the desktop, and she opened a PDF, and I don't have a PDF reader installed because I don't really use that computer for that kind of stuff. So it went to the reader app, and then she couldn't figure out how to get out. I let her sit for 5 or 6 minutes, and she, she found the right click menu. She got out to the root of the reader app. She got the charms to come up, but didn't make the transition from there. She never uses the Windows key on the keyboard. It's not something that she uses. She always just goes and clicks on the start button like normal people do. She was able to figure out how to print eventually, but only because she knew Control P is the shortcut for printing. She couldn't get the charms to do any printing because she didn't think, oh, I should go to devices on these charms. And eventually I had to just show her how to click that you go to a place on the bottom left corner of the screen where there's absolutely no indication that you should move the cursor there, and the icon for the start menu, start screen pops up. But it took 6 minutes before she was pissed off enough that she was like, this is going to be your problem if you don't tell me how to do this. And so I let her go back to budgeting stuff.
I avoided the Windows key for probably a good decade because I remember playing Tomb Raider on PC as a kid.
That's a good experience.
And if I pressed the Windows key, it would crash the game.
Yeah.
And so I just like that key it's almost, is like well, off limits. Don't ever touch it.
For a long time, I pried both the insert key, which just fucks up the cursor, and the start button off of my keyboards.
That's why they're keyboards that you can turn off the Windows key.
Yeah.
Specifically for games.
Yeah. So I hope that the rumors of removing the start menu, start screen, returning the start menu and removing the start screen are true. I think that would be very welcome.
Presumably, this is a free,
yeah.
All free update stuff.
Yeah. Should be. I think that's it for news, unless there's anything else to report. Did the Kepler stuff happen? Have we missed? It might have already happened by now, actually. We're recording a little late today. I'm going to play some music. We'll talk about what we've been testing. I just blasted Norman West. Sorry about that.
With audio.
Audio. What, I don't, never mind. Norm, what have you been testing?
I've been testing the Surface Pro. The Microsoft Surface Pro.
Do you like the Microsoft
tablet
Surface
laptop?
Pro?
How's that Windows 8 experience?
I'm loving that desktop. There are many,
what's,
many
what's your
things.
Favorite modern app?
Legitimately, my favorite modern app is OneNote.
Okay.
Because I can write in it.
Okay.
There are maybe three or four modern apps. You know what? If I'm going to watch Netflix on this, I will load up the Netflix modern app and not go to Netflix.com in a browser.
That makes perfect sense on a thing with a touch device, touchscreen especially.
And that's where there are interesting things. When there is a desktop version and also a modern app version, and how do you decide what works for you? So, for example, I like using Twitter on desktop. But I know a lot of people like having a dedicated Twitter on the side. And the Twitter app, which the Twitter modern app, just released relatively recently for Windows 8, is barely acceptable. It's good for what it does, but then it's very minimal, and there's some design elements I really don't get. And I've tried using that for extended periods just on the side of the screen, the 220 pixel wide side version of that, and that's okay. This is not about Windows 8. It's about the Surface Pro. It's amazing that they can pack a full laptop hardware and this high-resolution screen and a battery in this form factor. I think that is a technical achievement.
Yeah.
But just because it is amazing from a technical perspective doesn't mean that it's usable or makes sense for most people. This is not a device you can use as a laptop. You can't put this on your lap and type with it. I'm using the type keyboard also.
I've seen like popular opinion among people I follow on the internet and talk to regularly is really split on this, between this and the Yoga, the 13-inch Yoga, which you quite liked, as I recall.
I like the 13-inch Yoga, and I can't wait for the 11-inch, the Yoga 11S.
With X86?
Because that's X86, yeah. And because it has a fixed lock keyboard. And the biggest difference between those type of products and this type of products is that the hardware, instead of being behind the screen, is behind the keyboard.
Yeah, so it's not top heavy.
And this being top heavy is the worst thing about the Surface Pro. It does take the temperature, and it does get quite warm temperature off of the bottom. So if you're trying to use this as a laptop, the keyboard's not going to get very warm because the back of the screen will be very, very warm.
Have you tried using it with a lap board? Like a desk? Like one of those things?
No, just straight on my lap.
Okay.
A lap board's going to be even weirder because of the stand,
I think. Little slide.
As a lap experience, you like the Yoga a lot more, right?
Oh, yes. Much more. I mean, you can still use this in that without the keyboard in the lap, kind of holding it up and propping it up with the stand, and that works okay. But if you're going to do any serious typing and not touching on this, then you're going to need a more rigid keyboard. The other big thing, and this is an interesting aspect of the Surface Pro, because the resolution here is 1920 by 1200 or 1920 by 1080.
Yeah.
And the Yoga was, I believe, 1280 by 800. It's too high resolution.
For the desktop?
For the desktop. And Windows scaling is not ideal. It defaults to 150%. A lot of people say 125% is a sweet spot, but I still think that text renders really poorly in Chrome at 100, anything that's not an integer multiplier.
Right.
And so I run it at 100%, which makes it tiny, and it's usable for me because I like, tiny text is fine to read, but very difficult to touch, to hit the touch points. So if I want to minimize a window, maximize a window, hit certain things with my finger on the screen, at 100% zoom, it's very difficult to use. And then if I plug this into a separate monitor over DisplayPort, because it has DisplayPort, which doesn't work with Apple Cinema displays, then that's also, if I'm at 100%.
Hold on, why does it not work with Cinema displays?
It just doesn't work with Cinema displays.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an old Cinema display, right?
I have an old 24-inch.
Yeah.
Then You can't do independent scaling between the
Two different displays,
the Surface and an external laptop.
I don't think Windows can do that. I don't think Mac can OS 10 can do that.
That's a problem with with both those OSs.
Wes, what have you been testing?
So I threw ScumVM on the list, and this is not something I've really been spending much time with. I just thought it was of note, and plenty of people probably know this already. But so ScumVM is an emulator that lets you play old LucasArts adventure games and other games, and some of those have now kind of like crept up on Steam, and you can good old games, and you can actually buy them, and that's great. And there are like a couple HD remakes, like Secret of Monkey Island. I think I can't remember if they did both the first and second games with like HD remakes, but I know they did the first one.
They were iOS versions of both of those. I don't know if they were both HD remakes, but they were both, like, they released the, because remember in those days you could buy the game two ways. You could buy it on floppy disks
or CD,
or get CD with voice acting
or just high quality audio in the early days.
Yeah.
But yeah, so a lot of those games, adventure games, particularly the Sierra adventure games, you can't buy.
And even if you have the original discs, they're really hard to get running. Like, Scum games were hard to get running in modern Windows.
Yeah. And so a lot of those games are up on, like, abandonware sites. And, you know, those are, like, the legality of those is kind of a gray area because
it's not a gray area.
Okay. They're illegal. Okay. But there's no way to purchase those games really short of buying a floppy set off eBay.
Yeah.
And those companies have basically given up on those games.
I mean, a lot of those companies don't exist anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Or what'll happen is one company will own part of the rights, and Sierra, which is now, I guess, Activision. Sierra got bought by Vivendi, and Vivendi got bought by Activision, right? Mm-hmm. So Sierra owns a portion of the, Activision owns part of the rights, and then the rest of the rights are owned by some completely defunct company that doesn't exist anymore.
Right. So anyway, the few of those games that you can buy on, like, good old games, it's awesome to be able to do that. But the other ones, like ScumVM, is kind of one of the few ways you can play them. So I was messing around with an old game called Conquest of the Longbow.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago, and I was trying to play it in DOSBox, and it ran like complete ass.
On a relatively nice PC, right?
On a overclocked gaming PC.
Okay. Yeah, right.
Did not run well. And so I was just trying it in ScumVM earlier, because ScumVM, in addition to running all of the LucasArts Scum games, also runs all of the Sierra adventure games that were done in their language.
So everything like Gabriel Knight and all that stuff? Or is that predate?
That might be too new. Okay. I'm not sure. But like, especially their late 80s, early 90s stuff. So yeah, when I say all, but like definitely King's Quest, probably all the Police Quest games.
Leisure Suit Larry
Quest,
and all that
stuff. Yeah, like Quest for Glory, I think.
There's a space one.
Space Quest. Space Quest. Yeah. So I haven't looked into like the specifics of which games of sports, but a lot of them.
I didn't realize that it had become a general purpose, like, 2D adventure game simulator.
Yeah, so, and there's some other systems they support as well, in addition to Scum and Sierra, and it's multi-platform. So the way the thing works basically is it's taking the original code and then translating it into whatever ScumVM is programmed into, and so you can run these old, like, DOS PC games on Linux or on Mac OS X, and it's like, and it has a graphical user interface, so you seriously just click load on the game and have like these Windows PC files on your Mac, and you load it, and then it just runs.
That's really cool.
And so I just tried Conquest of the Longbow earlier, and it ran better than it did in DOSBox on the wrong platform. So I thought that was interesting.
The emulation stuff's really neat, and in a, I mean, there's like anything on the internet, right? There's a good side and a bad side to emulation, and the bad side is used for piracy, and the good side is used to make sure that stuff that would otherwise be unplayable in a modern age is still accessible, and you can kind of go back and learn from that stuff. I'd used GOG a little bit, or Good Old Games a little bit, but I got on the other day when they had a sale, just because an email popped up, and bought I think SimCity 2000. And Alpha Centauri, because I'd never played Alpha Centauri, and the fact that I could go back there and get that without spending $80 on YouTube on eBay was great. And it's a fantastic game; it still holds up. I think there should be an iOS version of that game. I would love to play that, or also Sim Golf. While we're talking about Sid Meier games,
so Scum is on Windows, Linux, Mac, Dreamcast, Palm OS, PSP, PS2, Symbian. Like, it's on basically everything.
Everything that doesn't have a curated app store, basically. And you can get Android versions of ScumVM, too, I believe. Did you say that? You might have said that.
I didn't say Android, but I bet it's on there, too.
I'm reasonably sure.
The list ended with ... Okay. So.
I'm going to go fire up the Dreamcast, jailbreak it or root it or whatever it is you do to Dreamcast.
You don't. You just put a disc in it.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like it's a CD, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you just had to be able to just burn them. Some games needed...
Oh, right.
You either needed a boot disc or a lot of games after the Dreamcast died and like it was just an emulation machine, basically.
Yeah.
A lot of people would just make disc images with the boot like partition that you needed on it. And so you just burn a game and boot it up. It was pretty cool.
That is crazy. I downloaded Wunderlist the other day. So
what is that?
It's a list tool. It's like Remember the Milk or Reminders or something like that. It's much more robust than Reminders. You can make a list that has sublist items. So, for example, if you want to have a shopping list, then you can share a shopping list for your house or whatever. Here's all the stuff that we need from Target. Here's all the stuff we need from the grocery. Here's all the stuff that we need for this stuff. And you can do sublist underneath. It's really pretty. It has a tickable sublist, and it all shares in a really seamless way, both amongst all of your devices and your laptop and stuff, and with other people. So if I share a list with you, Norm, mm-hmm. then you can get easy access.
But if I don't have the app, is there a presentable web format?
There is a presentable web format, and it also will, when you share it with someone, it says, hey, here's how to do it. Wunderlist is free. You can download the app on your stuff. I'm a little curious how they're going to make money, because it seems like their goal is to build an ecosystem around this where you can buy apps that are tailored for specific kinds of lists and uses and things like that.
Another sub-app store.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that people are going to be really keen on that. I'd much rather pay them like $20 a year and just be good or buy updated versions of the apps every year or so or whatever they need to do to support them. But it's quite nice. I mean, if you look, you can see the list come up in a very satisfying way, and they let you check stuff off and all that kind of thing. Gene and I have been using it to do shopping stuff recently, which
is nice.
The problem
for me for that is that I would use lists and reminders. I would create them with Siri. So
I use them for two different things. I use Siri for don't forget shit at home or don't forget shit at the office. Mm-hmm. And I use this
for time-based reminders and location-based.
You can do time and location-based on this as well, but you can't. It doesn't have the Siri integration that you're talking about. Right. I use this more for like task-based stuff. And
I use a notepad document.
See, that's the other way to do it. I had been doing that and using Just Notes for that, but I found that having a way to easily share that with people who didn't sign up for Just Notes was actually much more valuable. Oh. It's neat. It's free. I mean, there's no upside. Yeah. There's no downside. I've also been using Fantastical and Sunshine. So Fantastical is a paid app, and it's different on the phone and tablet and on the Mac. So these are all Mac apps. I apologize if you're a PC person.
I haven't used Fantastical on tablet. How is it on tablet?
It's just there's no tablet version. Oh. It's the phone. You get the phone version big. I love the way it presents the calendar on the app on the phone. But what I really love more is the kind of it lives in your menu bar on the Mac. It's a much more expensive app on the Mac. But it lives in the menu bar. You click on it, it drops down, and then it does natural language parsing to create new events.
So when you say meeting at 4 p.m. at tested office,
yes,
then it will
it automatically
the time
populates
and location into the right fields.
Yes. It works much. You can even specify if you have multiple calendars, it specifies that.
It does it in real time as you're typing.
Exactly. And the other thing that I really like is it integrates much better with Google Calendar than iCal does on the Mac. You never have those weird sync conflicts because it uses Card Dev or uses an API or something instead of Exchange or whatever janky way.
Or in a way that Microsoft doesn't even support anymore.
Yes, exactly. Google, you mean?
Google doesn't support on Microsoft devices.
Yeah. The last thing I've been doing is Arduino debugging. I built a timer app that has a hardware component and it has buttons and stuff. So I've been learning a lot about, if you need, I need microsecond accuracy on the timer to do what I want to do, or tens of microsecond accuracy. And actually debugging a loop that runs consistently 24 or 30 times a second and figuring out how to get the timing exactly right has been a really interesting kind of brain puzzle it hasn't taken as long as I've thought, but it's very satisfying kind of programming just using the Arduino stuff in general. We've been talked about this a lot on the podcast, but I don't know. You took intro to CS and stuff like that when you were in school, Norm.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Wes, did you do any programming in school or not really?
No, not much.
So I found like programming CS 100 classes where you were using either C or Fortran, or I think they probably do Python and stuff now, if I had to guess. I found it to be kind of unsatisfying because when we were doing this, it was before you could really do write real actual code for the web. It was before JavaScript and stuff like that. So there wasn't a whole lot actionable that you produced at the end of a semester, or even two semesters or three semesters.
It's concepts, did you?
Yeah, it was all highly conceptual. There was a lot of weird math, and you didn't ever get. Like there was no interaction with the real world or with something that would ever be useful. So like at the end of the first or second semester of CS100, our project was to build a CD library application that ran on Unix and was a command line CLI based. So it is the least useful piece of software ever created. And every kid in the classes did that. And it was a complete waste of time. You had to type stuff in manually. It was before there were databases of information accessible on the internet. So you couldn't even just type in a UPC code or something like that to auto-populate the artist and album and all that. The Arduino stuff gives a really nice physical component to that. So when you're doing loops and things like that, and you actually can make the light up or make a timer countdown or make a buzzer buzz or make a motor turn, it's really, really satisfying. And at least for me, and makes abstract concepts much more approachable. So if you took computer science classes and had the same experience I had, which seems to be pretty common when I talk to people, it might be worth exploring it because it's kind of neat. And the programming required is super duper basic.
Do you have anything planned for Maker Faire?
I don't know if it'll be ready for Maker Faire, but we have some really cool stuff planned. My next project is an Arduino. Actually, the next two projects are probably Arduino projects. So
Maker Faire is May 19th.
We will be there.
It's coming up soon.
Yeah, next month.
A month from tomorrow.
Yeah. That'll do it for what we're testing. Unless anybody has anything else to add. I did some cone stuff. If you're interested in the Able Brewing System or cone brewing system, it's on the site now. You should check it out. I mean, it's a specialty coffee thing, and I think it's pretty awesome if a bit expensive due to being made in America. You want to do questions?
Yes.
Emails?
Well, but we do the other one.
Emails.
We don't do emails. We do
emails.
No.
Questions.
Boom. If you have a question for This Is Only a Test, the email address is podcast@tested.com. We like audio questions. If you keep them short, under 45 seconds, and make sure that they don't sound like you were, you know, hanging out on the outside of an airplane when you recorded it, that would be awesome. We are also taking questions for Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. That's the same email address, podcast@tested.com. Put questions for Adam in the subject line. And
wait till next week.
You don't want to tease it now? You don't want to tell people now?
No, I'm not.
You want to make them wait?
Make them wait.
Man, Norm, you're harsh. That's brutal, man.
It's called showmanship.
So next week, wait for something to happen on Monday. Theoretically, maybe, I guess. Here is our first question.
Hi, testing crew. Matt from San Diego with a question about cameras. First, though, a bit of trivia about my school. UC San Diego is the setting of a large portion of Gregory Benford's sci-fi classic, Timescape. A bit dry of a read, but I'd recommend it to any fans of the genre. Anyway, I'm in the market for a new video camera for live streaming from my home studio. I'd like to take a step up from the Logitech webcam I already have, but can't decide between my options. 720p with decent glass is all I really need, and I have an extra HDMI capture card to throw at the problem, so there's plenty out there that'll do the trick. Would you guys recommend I go the GoPro route, a full HD camcorder, or something else entirely? I'm even considering upgrading my DSLR body at this time. Is there a Canon body that'd give me clean HDMI output and wall power for this use? For DSLR bodies, I'd like to keep it in the $1,000 range. Anything else, I'd like to keep below $400. Thanks, and always be testing.
That was a well-produced audio question.
He's not going to be able to buy, unfortunately, a DSLR body that does that, especially if you want wall power and a clean HDMI out. Most HDMI outs on those cameras are mirrors of what the interface sees, so you'll get all the UI.
So if you want to make Cloverfield, you're good to go.
Well, way more UI than that.
Oh, okay.
Even. The power adapters for Canon cameras are very expensive. If you want to go with the Canon brand ones, I think they're $130.
You can do live HDMI out of a GoPro, though.
You can, but then you don't have zoom or glass change.
No, that's true.
It to two angles. But if you want, if your budget is going to be under $400, then GoPro might be your best option.
Yeah, and the for what you get, the image quality is pretty good. Yeah. The medium field of view is like, I think the wide field of view is like 170 degrees, and the medium, which is the one that I usually use, is about 110.
I think you're going to get most use out of buying a GoPro. Camcorder will probably give you the best image quality and adjustability.
Yeah.
But it's not as versatile as a GoPro. You can't put it on a skateboard.
I mean, then the nice thing about a GoPro is we bought a what are the knobbly tripods called? The Gorillapods. You get by a Gorillapod and the tripod mount for the GoPro, and you can pretty much hang it anywhere. So, one more question.
Hey guys, this is Brian from Dublin. A couple of episodes ago, Norm mentioned that he did not like Micro Four Thirds cameras, and I was just wondering if he could explain his reasoning for this. While I can see that he might be attracted to the larger sensor in APS-C, he possibly does not realize that this actually makes lenses in APS-C larger and more expensive. The smaller sensor of Micro Four Thirds allows the lens to use less glass and is therefore cheaper and lighter. As well as this, Micro Four Thirds manufacturers have been producing some interesting technology recently, such as the 5-axis image stabilization in the Olympus OMD EM5, which allows for handheld shots down to 1/10 of a second. Thanks, and always be testing.
Even though it's cheaper, if you're going to go with interchangeable lens, I mean, then image quality, the sensor size is showing its date. You can get faster processors and better features, but the image quality is what you want at the end, and APS-C or bigger is going to get you much better than that. And it's unfortunate that Panasonic Olympus are so stuck on Micro Four Thirds. They just announced new ones, you know, last week, and I think if you're going to go with a smaller sensor, then go with a fixed-on system.
So, I mean, so you look at it purely as image quality is better.
Oh, yeah.
Bigger sensor size equals better image quality, and don't care that the lenses are going to be marginally more expensive.
Yeah, if
you're investing in a lens system with interchangeable lenses.
Yeah, and the prices are not all that different.
Yeah, they're competing. So that'll do it for questions this week. And I guess that wraps up the show.
There's also a big thing on the table that we didn't talk about and what we're testing.
Which was?
The Oculus Rift.
Oh!
That thing.
You want to talk about in fake outtakes?
Sure.
Oh, today's outro is brought to you by Ventilator.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
Here's a secret. I don't like StarCraft. I think that was a carefully edited lie.
Out of context is what you're saying?
Way out of context. I don't remember saying those words.
You love StarCraft. Everything love that StarCraft. Starts with Star. Craft, Wars, Trek.
Yeah. Yeah,
Gate,
and
even.
Especially Gate. And what was Starbound?
Starbound is a new game.
Oh, that game's good.
It's not out yet.
It looks good.
It looks good, yeah.
Hold on, I'm thinking...
The guys who made Terraria, or one of the guys who worked on Terraria is working on a game called Starbound with other people.
Is it a 2D... I'm thinking about the 4X game that's Star something that's out on Steam like
Sins
maybe a month ago.
Empire?
No. That's
Star...
I know what you're talking about.
It looks like it comes out of Eastern Europe, and it is... Like, the art looks real specific. It's very reminiscent of X2 and X3, like, from ship designs and stuff like that. But I enjoyed it. Okay, maybe it's Europa.
So it's a flying... It's a strategy game if it's 4X.
It's a 4X.
So it's not a shooting game, like a simulator like X2, X3.
I didn't realize that Starbound was... I thought that was called Starbound. But what's... So explain Starbound. Sorry.
So Starbound, these guys actually just launched a little... Kickstarter that's not Kickstarter. They're just funding, doing a pre-order campaign through their own website. They set up a system for it, and they've gotten like close to $1 million already. But they've been working on this game for like a year, year and a half, and it's basically Terraria, meaning that you have the same kind of 2D adventure building, mining
like
mechanics.
Going and hunting for stuff and crafting them into neat things.
Yeah, with some kind of RPG stuff in there, except instead of the scale being... a little world with like different types of environments in it.
And to be fair, Terraria was a pretty big world.
Yes, yes. The scale of this game is the universe.
So
it's infinite?
The worlds are themselves the same size as Terraria, except then you can load up different instances.
Or I don't know how big the worlds are in comparison. I think they're probably going to be smaller and mm-hmm. they're more specific. Like they toyed with having a planet that would have, you know, icy cap mountains and then, you know, jungles and stuff. But they kind of went more with like the Star Wars route where like themed planets, basically.
Right.
So you'll have an ice planet, a jungle planet.
Yeah, yeah.
But then they'll also have some sub biomes within that they've talked about. So there will still be variety on like a planetary level. And then you have a spaceship that you customize and fly around and you find different planets and you go to them and build cities or the mine for stuff or whatever you want to do with your friends. And
cooperative.
They're going to have some, they have like actual physics systems in the game now for when you're manipulating water. It's going to have some like wiring systems so you can do basic programming mechanics in the game. So it's going to be pretty deep.
Very cool. Yeah. How much is it?
$15.
That's not bad.
I think it might be 20 when they actually launch it, but it's 15 now.
On Kickstarter.
And if you get a 4-pack, you know, it's like 12 or something per copy.
Did either of you play Starseed Pilgrim?
I was just talking to our roommate Evan from PC Gamer about that yesterday because it's kind of a hot indie game topic, but I don't really know much about it other than the fact that it is a hot indie game topic.
I was thinking about Endless Space, by the way.
Oh, I wrote a story about that last year.
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah. So when you say it came out like last week, did they put out an expansion?
I must have popped up on my
because it's been out for
a while. But yeah, I'm looking at it right now and I'm like, ooh.
They might have put out an expansion for it recently though.
Anyway,
Oculus.
Let's talk about Starseed for a sec. Did you play it?
I have not.
Oh, you should play it. It's real weird.
What
it's worth
it?
$6.
Describe it.
It's the indie-assest indie game I've played in a while. You place blocks and then things happen and you have to figure it out. I don't want to say anything else because
it looks almost Atari age, right?
In the same way that Fez looks like a SNES game, if you don't think about it be too hard and the pixels being too small and stuff like that, yes, it looks like an Atari game. It has 12 times as many pixels as an Atari game should, but. It's the game is the puzzle and you should just
Starseed Pilgrim.
Tomorrow Bethesda is revealing their next game from the creator of Resident Evil, Shinji Mikami.
Really?
It's his next survival horror game.
It's a new franchise.
He had a developer studio that got bought by Bethesda.
Yeah.
And so that's coming
Well, I mean, I don't know what it is, but it's not like a Oblivion style.
No.
Okay.
It's supposed to be survival horror, but of course it could be a survival horror RPG or survival horror themed action game or
open
world survival horror would be a great game to play with virtual reality.
Well, I think we should talk about that in a sec. I think we should wait just a minute. I think we should let that build a little bit. Let it fester.
But basically every game Shinji Mikami has worked on in the past decade has been good to amazing. So like he did a little game called Resident Evil 4.
That
a few people have played.
I think that was fine.
He worked on God Hand after that, which is a very like niche action game, but the people who like God Hand
I don't know what God Hand is.
It was on the PS2 and it came out real late.
Like Okami late?
Yeah. Okay. Like it might have been, it's probably within a year of the Xbox PS3. I'm not sure.
So it was this year. It was probably when the Xbox 360 was out, but the PS3 wasn't yet.
God Hand was out in 2006. So the year the PS3 came out.
So Okami.
But God Hand is beloved by some people. He worked on Vanquish,
which is
probably the most underappreciated shooter of this generation.
That's the like robot suit guy, Japan anime, super fast sliding. That game's
awesome.
Missiles.
It's basically taking the mechanics that God of War solidified, and then they're like, how about we make this way fucking cooler?
Yeah, put it. Yeah,
instead of it's all like the problem with cover based shooters that kind of developed is like, oh, now you're sitting in place all the time.
Yeah.
And Vanquish is like, you have to be extremely proactive because the only way you can use the awesome slow-mo is to be rocketing around all the time and on the move. So
constantly moving.
Yeah. So that game is really fun. And he worked on Shadows of the Damned.
Oh, that was the talking weapons,
with
right?
With Suda51. Yeah. Yeah. So this game is probably going to be awesome.
This is a list of games that I haven't played. The list you just, well, except for Resident Evil 4, which I think everybody's probably played.
Hopefully.
Interesting.
How would Resident Evil 4 be in the Oculus Rift? That laser sight?
Third person's rough.
Yeah, I
haven't played any third person stuff at all yet.
First person mod.
So should we talk about Oculus Rift? Is it time? Norm's been ready for a while. He's thinking.
I haven't been afraid about it.
I haven't really gotten to use it.
Oh, you didn't use it?
We tried to play Mirror's Edge with it. Yeah. And
how'd that go?
Did not go.
The game didn't render.
Like at all?
The perception drivers screwed up the game, so the game...
They were too far apart?
Well, no, it was weird. We tinkered with it. It would only show the UI. It wouldn't render the 3D. And then we...
disabled perception.
Disabled it. Set it to the proper resolution in case that would mess it up.
Yeah.
Booted up again, and it rendered. And so I like tabbed out to change something. I forget. Yeah. To figure out. So it was rendering, but we didn't have the right... focus or something on the two images. It wasn't creating proper 3D. So I tabbed out to figure out what the shortcuts were to fix that, which of course crashed the game, and then we couldn't get it to render after that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So
that's not officially supported.
No. So what you're talking about is a third party driver called the Vireo perception drivers. And they add
a bunch of different things.
What I would say is kind of janky support to a handful of games.
And on the bright side, like it's that driver is super easy to use because you just open the little app.
Yeah.
And then it drags as long as it's running.
Which type of mode you want to run it in.
Yeah. And it defaults to Oculus Rift. Yeah. So it's super easy to run.
Well, and then it taps into the 3D support provided by the video card drivers for like shutter glasses, basically.
But if, and so I want to try Mirror's Edge or some other things using this driver on like an NVIDIA card and just see if maybe like my AMD card was not playing nice with it or whatever. But I'm sure they will put out updates to it and make it better.
The most everything has stuff that you have to do in order to get it to work, whether it's to drop a DLL in the right file or a hacked version of the DX9 DLL or something like that. Let's talk about the Oculus, like the stuff that's officially supported though, because this came on Tuesday night, I guess. Tuesday night seems like. Monday night, came to my house. I opened it up, of course, immediately and plugged in TF2 and then proceeded to play TF2 after it was calibrated for about an hour.
Did you get motion sick at all?
I don't really get motion sick. Like it takes a lot for me to get motion sick. So I wasn't motion sick at the end. I had to go help, be a dad.
With your daughter, both puking.
No, she doesn't. She's slowed down on the puking
or
a lot.
Burping.
The burping is slowed dramatically in the last, she was on baby Zantac, which apparently is super overprescribed or whatever.
Oh my goodness.
But they have the valve at the top of the stomach that keeps stuff from coming back up the wrong way is underdeveloped in many children until they're about 3 months old. She's about 3 months old, so shit suddenly got better. This is one of the things apparently that happens, is that things are bad for a little bit and then they get better just about the time you can't take any more throwing up. It was really, I quite liked it. Like I didn't have motion problems. I put contact lenses on, which is the first time I've used it wearing without glasses on underneath, which was much more comfortable. I did get a pretty good headache by the end, but that's why I stopped wearing contacts. So I got to assume that was probably because of the contact lenses, not necessarily because of the, I can't say whether that was the glasses or the goggles. But the experience was really good. I played on servers with like 25 people, 30 people on them, and like I wasn't as competitive as I normally am, but I also wasn't hobbled.
When I didn't feel like I want to throw up, the actual playing of TF2 was a lot of fun. I would want a tighter keyhole, but moving your mouse around, it really was just point and click at the enemies.
Yeah, the ability to move the cursor independent of the rest of the screen, super powerful.
Yeah,
More so for like the direct hit and the whatever the Liberty launcher, the other fast rocket launcher, are both super powerful with that. The heavy chain gun is really good because it's just basically you just keep the cursor on and it becomes a much easier game. What else?
Did you notice any benefit in like situational awareness or something from the 3D?
I found defending points, the 3D less so. I thought at first I had a lot of trouble getting the demo sticky grenades in the right place. And then after it kind of clicked, it was a little bit easier. It was really nice when you were defending points, like point A on Gravel Pit, to be able to kind of look side to side and not just be glued straight ahead. So that way it meant I could actually be shooting machine guns down the street while I was looking to the left, to the stairs coming up from the low point, which I felt like probably gave me a pretty good advantage. I mean, I can't imagine ever trying to use it in a competitive situation because the resolution is really low. You can't read text at all. There is definitely some eye strain when you take them off, even after you've kind of become accustomed to them. Then there's a period of time where you're kind of blinking and it's like your eye gets so used to focusing up close that there's like muscle fatigue or something that means focusing far away suddenly is a challenge and you have weird perspective issues. But it's really cool. Like I think it is a, I put Gina on the Tuscan. I put it on Gina and did the Tuscany demo, which is what the now famous grandma did.
Best person of the year. Oculus grandma.
I think exploiting our grandparents for internet lols.
She wasn't exploited.
Oh,
no.
You have no idea.
It was a gift.
Okay.
Change her life. She wants to live to 110.
It's gonna.
She makes great oatmeal cookies.
It's gonna cause a lot of grandma exploitation.
Other people
are gonna exploit their grandmas. It's gonna happen, Norm. Anyway, she put it on, and I didn't. I think the best way to do this is to not let them know that they can move. So you put the goggles on them and tell them to just look around and act like that's the whole thing, and then tell them they can move. Because when I made the Tuscany demo move with Gina, she almost fell out of her chair.
Is that with an Xbox controller?
I used an Xbox controller so I could go slow.
Did you move it?
And I moved it. I was like, are you ready to go forward? She's like, you can go forward? And then when it moved, she jumped. When there's little puffs of like dandelion fuzz that float around outside. And when one of those came by, she like did a hard jerk to the left to avoid. And again, almost fell out of the chair.
It reminds me of playing like Sega Genesis with parents or like Mario. And whenever you try to like jump over a gap, lift the controller up in the air. It's kind of...
When you play racing games, do you lean? When you play racing games, do you lean?
No.
Everybody does a little bit.
I'm sure I have.
You make the room room sounds more than you lean.
Well, you make the sounds. When you were playing the Epic Citadel demo, Norm, you were singing the Game of Thrones song.
That's the best way to play it.
I have that on my phone, by the way.
There you go.
What did you think, Norm? You took it home, too.
Yeah. I couldn't do more than 10, 15 minutes in TF2.
Which is what they say you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
In fairness.
Yeah, with calibration. Calibration helps dramatically. Epic Citadel is the best demo so far, I think, but really makes you want a Skyrim open world game.
Yeah, I think Skyrim would be really crazy.
Yeah, or even
a real time survival, open world survival horror.
The Jonathan Blow's
The Witness.
The Witness.
I'd like to play
The Witness.
Knowing his design philosophy, I feel like that game would probably be pretty light on direct text in your face and much heavier on symbols and iconography and stuff. So if that's true, then potentially that would work with the low res screen.
I want to play the Chris Hecker's game, the sniper game, Spy Party. I think it only works in, it's like an asymmetric mode.
Mm-hmm. So then, as you would play it as the sniper.
As the sniper. And the other person is third person in the party, I think, right? Or is it first person in the party? I can't remember.
I don't know.
It's definitely like, I'm going to reiterate, like you shouldn't, if you're thinking about going out and pre-ordering one of these for $300, you should just wait. Yeah. Like unless
find
you're
a friend who has one.
Unless you're going to make games with it, then there's no, or have a project that's going to use it. Don't spend money on this one. Cause it's when they have the screen resolution, right. And when they add the lateral motion to the head tracking, it'll change the dynamic of the thing pretty considerably.
And you'll thank yourself when the real one comes out and you haven't already spent $300 on it.
Yeah. If you want to get one of these, you are not going to be able to use this full time for games. If you want to get one and you have like three other friends who each want to put in $75, absolutely do that. Don't you think, Norm?
I wouldn't use this as a replacement for my monitor.
Yeah, you can't use it as a replacement for your monitor. You can't read text on it. You can't use you can't see a desktop on it at all. I'm able to play pretty much indefinitely right now. I think we'll do an endurance stream at some point in the future just to see what happens.
How long
I can go.
I'm pretty sure I would vomit using this thing.
There's also in the Tuscany demo, you can change the actual field of view. The game renders, and by widening that field of view, it looks like you're drunk.
Well, it's rot, right? Isn't that how rot did drunkenness? Rise of the Triad. The magic mushrooms, and all of a sudden the FOV was all swirly and weird.
Maybe.
The upshot is, you are not going to use this as a primary way to play games. It is a novelty only. So figure out what your novelty price is, and then multiply that by the number of people you need to get to $300. And if you want it, then order it. So
you mean specifically the developer kit?
Yeah, I would not spend money expecting to use this to play games.
Okay.
Anything else? What do we want to talk? What are we having for lunch? It's that time.
Some food.
Thanks, Wes. Thanks for your.
I was thinking about T-dubs, but I don't know if I can.
I can't do T-dubs today.
I'd go to AJ's, AK's, get some pastrami.
AK.
AK.
Does feel like a smoothie day. All right. I don't want to talk about it.
See you guys next week.
Smoothies.
Smoothies.
Smooth.